The Guardian.
Hey, it's Lee Alexander, and before you get started with this episode of Chips with Everything, we wanted to point you in the direction of our sponsor, Squarespace. For everything you need to set your website apart, head to squarespace.com/guardian to get 10% off your first purchase. And now here's the show.
Yvonne and Chester Rich are getting ready for Y2K.
A lot of crackers and stuff for the cats.
Salmon. We have a gas stove so I can cook. If I have water, we're going to stack up on a little water.
Hey, and welcome to this week's episode of Chips with Everything. I'm still filling in for Lee Alexander while she's away in America, but we have an amazing show for you today. In this week's episode, we'll be discussing the three-character acronym that brought the world to a standstill at the turn of the millennium.
Most items can be gathered at your local grocery store, such items as non-perishable food, a manual can opener, personal hygiene items such as shampoo, soap, deodorant, and a toothbrush,
eyeglasses. Y2K, year 2000, also known as the Millennium Bug.
They're making too much out of it. It's not going to be anything. Just another day. Of course, I may be wrong.
We all know what the Y2K bug was, and we all know that planes never fell out of the sky, and our toaster ovens didn't explode while we were making toast. But as we'll discuss in today's episode, there are some lessons to be learned from the Y2K bug that are as applicable today as ever. On today's show, we'll explore exactly what the Y2K bug was and how it was averted, what the next potential iteration of the Y2K bug might look like, and what we should be doing today to avoid a mass technological failure in the future.
Hi. Good talk to you. Am I close enough to your microphone?
For today's show, we have Professor Martin Thomas in studio, who's worked as a software engineer in the computer science sphere for years and now holds regular lectures at Gresham College in London.
I'm Martin Thomas. I'm a software engineer. I've been in the software business for more than half the time there's been a software business. I started back in 1969, so it's been a long time. And as far as Y2K is concerned, I actually ran the international business of Year 2000 services for Deloitte & Touche as an international partner in Deloitte's for a few years in the mid-90s, in the run-up to the millennium changeover.
With the turn of the millennium in view, in the 1980s, Martin set up a company called Praxis that specialized in building computer systems that didn't fail for people who pretty much, from a business perspective, had applications and computer systems that couldn't fail.
Air traffic control, medical applications, big business systems, and so on.
And Martin was part of a large network of computer scientists around the world who were all doing things kind of just like what Praxis was doing, taking existing fragile technology systems and making them much more reliable so as to be able to withstand whatever December 31st, 1999 might bring.
Oh, December 31st, 1999. I was filling the bath with cold water and making sure that it didn't leak, just in case, and making sure that I'd got enough food and other materials in the house, just in the event. Not really because I thought anything was going to go badly wrong, but because, given how close I'd been to the year 2000 problem, it would have been hugely embarrassing to be caught out by it.
The Y2K bug was stemmed from the fear that computer systems that represented years as two digits, for instance, 1999 as 99, that those computer systems would fail when the year rolled over to 00, also known as 2000. That was because computer systems typically worked according to the logic that every year those numbers would get larger and not smaller. And a combination of that misstep and also storage limitations in devices resulted in widespread panic over how our technologies would respond to the year 2000.
I regard it as a signal event, one of these near misses that it's very important that you learn from. And I don't think we've learned from it yet. I don't think we've taken the right lessons out of the year 2000 problem. And all the people who say it was all a myth just prevent those lessons being learned and mean that next time there really will be a calamity.
So when we talk about Y2K, what sort of technologies are we actually talking about failing? Are we talking about, you know, small appliances at home, like dishwashers and toasters? Or are we talking, you know, the quintessential Y2K example of planes falling out of the sky?
Planes were never a problem because the aircraft industry isn't interested in dates. The dates that the computer systems used in the aircraft industry work with are simply a flag to say whether you're talking about today or tomorrow. But it's extremely rare for an aircraft to take off and land 2 days later. So it's enough to say today or tomorrow. The sort of things that were failing, all kinds of things, lots of commercial systems, of course, where you were processing dates inevitably because an awful lot of commercial systems depend on dates. They depend on contracts that have got dates. They depend on foodstuffs that have got expiry dates.
According to Martin, one of the first recorded Y2K problems that was experienced happened in the 1980s when Marks & Spencer, which is a grocery chain here in the UK for our American listeners, when they took in an order of corned beef with an expiry beyond 2000. And as a result, their entire stock control system failed. The expiry label on the cans of corned beef read as expiring in 2002, but when the Marks & Spencer worker tried to scan the cans in when stocking the shelves, the system rejected the product, interpreting the expiry date as 1902 rather than 2002. After a back and forth with the corned beef supplier, they realized that it wasn't the product that was the issue, it was the system itself causing the problem.
Because it looked as though they failed back in 1900, and that was the expiry date. And so it rejected an entire batch of very long-lived tinned meat, thinking that it was already getting on for 100 years out of date. But we found problems in offshore oil platforms and the control systems there. We found problems in factory scheduling. We found issues in some limited air traffic control systems simply because of the compatibility between one system and another and one of them doing a calculation that was then rejected by another. So it was very, very widespread, the problems that occurred.
So am I correct here in saying that the main issues in Y2K pretty much stemmed from these computer systems and the software not being able to handle sort of the variation, the change in the couple numbers in the 99 turning into the 00?
No. No, the problem arose originally because when most commercial systems were being programmed before the 1990s, computer power was extremely expensive and storage was extremely expensive. It's quite hard to recall that, you know, back in 1960 and 1970, a computer would occupy a room the size of a football pitch and be run 24 hours a day and still only support a single organization, like when I started the computer in University College was an IBM 360 65, and it was supporting all the students and staff in University College, a single computer. It cost £2 million in 1969 money, and today I've got about 10 times as much processing power in my iPhone and vastly more storage in my iPhone. And it was because those things were so expensive, because processing was expensive, and in particular because storage was so expensive, that full dates weren't stored. Only the year digits were stored in the data. And so all the calculations for sorting dates implied that the year, that the century was the 1900, that was the 20th century, and therefore put a 1-9 on the front for doing sorting. The moment that you had a date range that crossed the millennium boundary, all those sorting algorithms went wrong, because 2001 looked as though it was much earlier than 1999, and so everything got sorted in the wrong order. And so it was that sort of problem that caused all the difficulties. The fact that firstly, you couldn't necessarily tell from the two-digit dates in all your data which century you were talking about. And then if you did start sorting data without having expanded all those fields into full four-digit years, all the sorts came out wrong.
As Martin will discuss, Y2K wasn't a case of technology experts and computer scientists waking up on the morning of December 31st, 1999, and realizing that, you know, maybe something will go wrong with our devices tonight. Far from it, actually. Martin says that he and many others were working for years in advance of 1999, preparing, developing, and redeveloping technological infrastructure so as to avoid mass technological failures.
Firstly, there was a lot of testing done in order to find whether systems would in fact fail. And also there was a lot of analysis done to find whether they'd fail or not. So a lot of special software was written that would scan the source code of programs, and indeed, to some extent, would scan the binary of programs in order to find date fields and then to flag them up so that programmers could examine whether the logic for processing those dates in the code would in fact continue to work across the millennium. So there was a lot of analysis done. There was a lot of testing done. And the advice for PCs, for example, was simply to set the clock forward into the next century and find out what happened. And that was one of the standard ways in which you discovered that quite a lot of your software wouldn't work, that it would simply go wrong. So a lot of those sort of steps were taken just to find whether you've got a problem. And then if you had, of course, you were faced with the decision. What did you do about it? Did you go through the code very carefully, rewrite it, make sure that it was correct? Or did you take the opportunity to throw away that system and implement a new one with new features?
A lot of people who decided to replace their older systems with new systems before the end of the millennium got caught out because many of those replacement systems were actually created in haste in preparation for 2000. When we come back, we look to the future and ask, what will the next Y2K look like, and how can we prepare for it?
The main problem that we face now is perhaps the cybersecurity threat. And the underlying problem of that, and indeed of Y2K, is the fact that the software industry is still very much a craft industry. It's not, in general, an engineering discipline.
Hey, this is Jason Phipps here, head of audio here at The Guardian. This episode of Chips with Everything that you are enjoying, no doubt, is sponsored by Squarespace. To find out more about how to set your website apart, head to squarespace.com/guardian.
If you like Chips with Everything, check out another great show produced in-house here at The Guardian, Science Weekly. For everything from black holes to the origin of humankind, Max Anderson and the science team have you covered. Tied in with The Guardian's Climate Change Day, this week's episode explores the psychology behind effective communication of climate change.
You know, it is not enough for us to be right. We have a lot of facts, we have a lot of statistics, we have a lot of reports, and it hasn't got us anywhere. And I think that, you know, sometimes we have tried to, you know, be the smarty pants, be the cleverest person in the room. And, you know, we often are kind of bogged down in our own rightness and have not thought carefully about what actually connects with people, what actually persuades people, what actually moves people to come with us and to take action.
That's Science Weekly from The Guardian. Search for it on iTunes or your favorite podcasting app. Concerning potential upcoming threats to technology and potential mass technology failures, Professor Thomas says that we should be concerned about cybersecurity, the risks that hacking pose, as well as, similar to Y2K, the huge amount of quote-unquote bad code that we're putting out into cyberspace. Here's Martin.
I'm much more worried about cybersecurity. I think that is a threat that is not yet being addressed strategically. We have to fix it at the root, which is by making the software far less vulnerable to cyber attack. And that certainly can be done, but we don't appear to be setting about any kind of strategy nationally or internationally that would bring that about. And yet we continually want to introduce more and more important software-based systems. And driverless cars scare the hell out of me in viewed through the lens of cybersecurity. We seem to feel that the right solution to the cybersecurity problem is to train as many people as we can to really understand how to look for cybersecurity vulnerabilities and then to send them out into companies to help them look for cybersecurity vulnerabilities without recognizing that what we're doing is training a bunch of people to find all the loopholes in our systems and then encourage companies to let them in and discover all their secrets. Giving people skeleton keys and letting them loose around all the locked doors, it doesn't feel like the right approach. And similarly, training lots of school students to write bad software, which is essentially what we're doing by encouraging, you know, app development in schools and that sort of thing, is just increasing the mountain of bad software in the world, which is our problem. It's not the solution.
So in addition to cybersecurity and hacking, Martin says that one of the biggest problems that we need to be wary of is the fact that we're not building software with the same degree of diligence and sophistication that we should be.
People don't approach building software with the same degree of rigor that engineers approach building other artifacts that are equally important. And the consequence of that is that most software contains a lot of errors. And most software is not managed very well. One of the big problems in the run-up to Y2K was that most major companies could not find the source code for their big systems, for their key business systems, and could not therefore recreate the software even in the form that it was currently running on their computers, because they'd hired a bright programmer who'd implemented some new features for a customer because somebody needed them urgently, and they'd built it all up in their own file store, and then they'd left and they'd never checked their version of the software into any central repository, and nobody else knew how to find it. So even attempting to rebuild the existing systems would typically reintroduce lots of bugs that had been fixed in the past. The lack of professionalism around managing software development and software was revealed by Y2K, and a lot of companies fixed that problem by introducing a much better governance structure for the way that they did software. But we still build software on the assumption that you can test it to show that it's fit for purpose.
And Martin says that system just doesn't work. As a computer scientist, him and his colleagues have known for the past 40-odd years that testing technology can only show the presence of errors, and you can never actually show the absence of errors through tests.
Because software is vastly complex, and a typical programmer makes a mistake in, if they're good, every 30 lines of program. If they're very, very good, they make a mistake in every 100 lines of program. If they're typical, it's in about 10 lines of code. And you don't find all of those by testing, not by a long way. And when a modern car has got 100 million lines of software, you know, even an error in one in 100 lines is still a million software errors in your car. And a lot of those are vulnerabilities that can be exploited as cybersecurity problems, for example. So we haven't learned that lesson, that we really need to adopt much more rigorous software engineering in building important computer systems. There are still potential things that could go wrong that could cause very widespread devastation. I mean, the number of services and computer systems that are dependent on GPS, for example, is unbelievably wide. You know, the timing signal is used on in stock market trading. It's used to synchronize mobile phone networks and computer networks. It's used in military systems. The positioning is used to very high accuracy for things like farming, and yet you're dealing with a signal that you can buy a jammer for on the internet for $100, and where if you bought a reasonably powerful jammer for $1,000 and stuck it in a balloon and floated it over London, you'd take out GPS over the whole of the south of England. The emergency services use GPS for finding out where their emergency vehicles are, for getting to the causes of accidents. Ships use it for navigation and for reporting where they are to other ships so they don't bump into each other in fog. And the dependence across the whole of society on that easily jammed and actually increasingly easily spoofed signal is astounding.
In essence, what Martin is illustrating is that these new age risks to technology aren't actually particularly sophisticated at all. According to Professor Thomas, it comes down to us simply not being diligent enough when writing code and creating software, and not appreciating how vulnerable and susceptible our technology is to being hacked and undermined. Finally, to round things off, I asked Martin how, if at all, we can change the infrastructure surrounding technology so as to teach people to be more diligent when building the technologies of the future, and hopefully avoid another Y2K scenario.
Helping people to understand that computer systems can be made to work, but that at the moment they are very vulnerable to going wrong because of the high error rates. And to try to get some public policy that helps to move us to a situation where we do treat developing computer-based systems with the same rigor as we treat developing other systems. That's what we need to do. At the moment, the people who make the money out of selling us computer systems don't carry the cost of those systems failing. We could fix that. We could say that in a decade's time, to give the industry a chance to really shape up, we were going to introduce strict liability in the way that we have strict liability for the safety of children's toys, for example. You know, if you manufacture a children's toy in the European Union, or if you import one into the European Union, and it's dangerous and somebody is injured as a consequence, then you are strictly liable for that, and you can be sued in the courts and damages can be recovered. And so we ought to do that for software-based systems, and at the moment we don't.
Thanks to Professor Martin Thomas for coming on the show this week. Martin has a lecture on the Y2K bug coming up at the Museum of London on April 4th. If you're interested in attending, there's a link below in the description of this episode. If you like today's show, you can subscribe on iTunes or on the podcasting app on your smartphone. Just search for Chips with Everything. Today's show was hosted and produced by me, Matt Shore, with production help from Rowan Slaney. Thanks for listening. We'll see you back here next week.
The Guardian has always been a community of readers, journalists, and contributors. And now our live events are bringing these people together.
The Guardian events are The Guardian at its best, which is a two-way conversation involving the reader and having a real, genuine, thriving debate.
Could be anything from food and culture, arts, to politics, to foreign affairs.
To see what events are coming up and to check out the benefits of membership, go to members.theguardian.com. Also, subscribe to the Guardian Live podcast. You can do so on iTunes, SoundCloud, and other reputable audio platforms.